previously on Wisco Weekly.
If I can convince somebody like you, Mr. Orange County auto dealer car guy, to rethink things, then I can convince the world.
And on this episode.
So if we are dependent on a gas tax model to pay for our infrastructure, I don't know how that pans out. It's like that's a bet that the technology in electric vehicles isn't going to continue to prosper and grow. So while, you know, California's done some great things with SB1 and addressing some immediate needs, long term, we have to look beyond the gas tax and realize that technology is going to change our ability to get sufficient revenues from the gas tax, but the usage of the facilities and the need for the facilities is still going to be there.
This is Wisco Weekly, an automotive business podcast sharing the voices of automakers, automotive retailers, and transportation professionals who are driving and shaping the future of automotive.
You are now tuned in to the Wisco Weekly Experience.
Chicken brown, cow. Listeners, welcome to another episode of Wisco Weekly. Thanks for tuning in and thanks for telling a friend. I am very, very happy on this Friday that I'm recording because while this does represent, well, when this episode gets published, it won't be the end of the month, but it is the end of the month of January. And certainly what better time to learn new things than the end of the month? My guest today is going to be uniquely qualified to talk about some of the things that are going on in transportation, infrastructure, and furthermore, technology. So let's introduce him. So I am very lucky to have this next guest on the show, and what a great background he has to share his insight and thoughts on the economic models of tolls. Today's guest is no stranger to technology. Whether back in the 90s when he served as chief technology officer of the San Diego Metropolitan Transit System, or when he was a small business owner providing IT consulting and support services, my guest approaches improvements to infrastructure without fear of technological change. Combining that with his responsibilities, such as overseeing tolling strategies, how money is made and collected effectively, for the TCA's 51 miles of roadway in Orange County, you can call him a practical futurist. He's a former student athlete and a proud fighting Aztec from San Diego State University, here to drop some knowledge on the economic models of toll roads, men, women, and children. Please welcome to the show, Mr. Samuel Johnson.
All right. Thanks for having me, Dennis. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm very thankful you're on the show here, and I am looking forward to learning about toll roads, how things are, you know, how you guys function as a business, how it functions within the community that you guys serve. So, I, you know, as Yoda would say,
learn from you, I will.
If that's the proper way to say it. That's a terrible Yoda impression. I don't do impressions very well, but that won't stop me.
It's better than mine.
So, first off, Samuel, how can people follow you?
So I'm not necessarily prominent on social media, but I do have a LinkedIn account, and occasionally I'll share some thoughts I have, or more likely pass on information and thoughts someone else shared that I thought was very interesting.
Excellent. So, and listeners, I'll put his LinkedIn info on the episode page. Well, Samuel, you know, when we first chatted, I want to apologize because I think I briefly cut you off, and I feel like I almost maybe crushed your hopes and dreams because you, as we were talking about more business related things, towards the end, you kind of said that, you know, you're very interested and passionate about kind of all things related to transportation. So I figured the first thing I'd like to ask you to make amends is, you know, what are some of the things about transportation that make you feel alive, or, you know, that maybe bother you, that keeps you up at night?
Yeah. So I would say it's kind of a mixed excitement, Dennis. I mean, our challenges in transportation have never been greater, but the solutions and the forethought being given to how we address those solutions with technology and financially, those opportunities have also never been greater. So it's a good time to be in transportation, where we're recognizing the needs and the benefits to our economies and our quality of lives, but also coming to the table with meaningful solution. And I know on the Hill next week in DC, they're gonna be talking about this issue and figuring out how do we really finance the transportation system we need here in America.
So what's going on in DC then?
So the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee is going to start having their hearings about a new surface transportation bill, which is very important. This is how the federal government funds and supports states and locals' efforts to develop and maintain our transportation networks.
Okay. I did not know about that, so I will be looking into that. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I thought we can kind of start at a very elementary level is understanding how the TCA, the Transportation Corridor Agencies, and the toll roads function. So can you maybe give me a breakdown of who that is, what are the responsibilities, and...
Sure. So the Transportation Corridor Agencies, or the TCAs, are actually two joint power governmental authorities established back in the 80s. And they were established by the local cities and the counties in the southern part of Orange County. And these leaders came together with the forethought that the state and federal financial pie was never going to grow big enough to be able to support the quality of life and economic prosperity we wanted here in Orange County. So they decided that, hey, this is a local problem. We want local control. We can fix this problem ourselves. So they decided to use non-recourse toll revenue bonds, which means there were no commitment of public tax dollars at all. All the funding to build these roads comes purely from the tolls that people pay when they use the roads. And we've built about $4 billion worth of infrastructure across four facilities, being State Route 73, State Route 133, State Route 241, and State Route 261. Today, these facilities are very successful. We carry about 350,000 vehicles per day, which if the roads weren't there, those 350,000 vehicles would be on the 5, the 405, and the 55.
Is there have you figured out what maybe the max capacity is of how many cars can the toll roads can serve? So you have 350,000 on any given day. What would be, give me an idea of capacity.
So that's one of the great things about this model and the way we use our funding. So as demand grows, we can manage demand by the toll rates we set, but we can also expand the facilities. So a big part of our program is reinvesting some of the toll revenue we've collected, reinvesting it back into the system to provide expansion. So of course, at some point, you know, you become landlocked, but I think we're far from that on any of our facilities.
Interesting. And so is there something unique about how the toll business model is a better model than, for instance, a gas tax?
I think so. I think there are probably two pieces there. First, it's directly related to the service you use. So you use the road, you pay. You don't use the road, you pay. Whereas, you know, tax models, you pay the tax and you might not necessarily see 100% of that benefit. So that's a key thing about tolling. And similar to the conversations California and other states and even the federal government is having with user-based fees, whether it be vehicle miles traveled, congestion pricing, there are a lot of different user-based fee models that are out there, and tolling is just one of them.
I mean, I certainly am a big fan of toll roads. I mean, I grew up in northern Orange County, and so I didn't use at the time a lot of tolls, but now that I'm living in South County, I find myself using the tolls all the time. And at first, I had an apprehension about using the tolls, more so because it's just like, you know, I mean, I grew up Asian. I was cheap, right? So, like, there's no need for me to spend an additional whatever, $6, $7, or actually even when I first started using it, I think it was like $2 and $3, mm-hmm. right? But now I it's like I'm thankful, and the cost to my pocket is negligible now. Mm-hmm. But you did bring up a good point in that, you know, because with the tolling model, you are serving the people that actually use it. And if you're not using, then obviously you're not paying for it. So, you know, this kind of brings to mind some of the things that are going on in LA County with mm-hmm. their congestion pricing.
Mm-hmm. You can do congestion pricing in tolling or with express lanes or even probably a less popular term here in the U.S., cordon pricing. And I know that's one of the models the folks in Los Angeles are looking at as well.
And so that model apparently has not been applied anywhere, if I read correctly.
It hasn't been applied anywhere in the U.S. Folks like New York City, looking at Manhattan, they've looked at it. I believe the folks in Seattle have looked at it as well, San Francisco. So it hasn't been deployed here in the United States, but it has been very successful when we look at our peers over in Europe. London has it. Stockholm has it. And Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
Which, as I was chatting with my good friend and transportation correspondent, Rudy Salo, as we were looking at the INRIX 2017 traffic study. So Los Angeles was on top. London, I think, was number 6, mm-hmm. but Stockholm and Singapore not on the list. So, you know, to a certain extent, I was kind of, you know, any time I would hear any comparison to Stockholm or Singapore, I'm always a bit wary on mm-hmm. the analogy to those cities. But certainly when you have a study that's showing that, you know, if the top 25 most congested cities are this is what the list is, uh-huh. and Stockholm and Singapore aren't on there, then there's probably a good reason why.
Correct.
So what is this cordon pricing then?
So cordon pricing, and you know, I just want to mention one aspect in all these models, right? People sometimes get hung up in that, well, only those who are willing to pay are the ones that benefit. That's far from the truth. You know, we should all take a selfish look. And if I can get the car in front of me out the way, I'm going to have a better trip. Mm-hmm. So even if I don't choose to use a toll road or an express lane or travel at a certain time of day when congestion pricing is in effect, well, if the person in front of me does, that just helps me get home faster.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in terms of how these models work, with cordon pricing, it essentially identifies a very congested area, usually around a city core. And it creates actually a ring, a cordon, you know, just a ring. And then pricing for entering that ring is set on certain times of day or whatever the public policy may be. If you are trying to travel during very congested times, and that community, that city, wants to reduce that congestion, well, they might charge a higher price for that time of day, mm-hmm. right? And it just pushes traffic out to times of the day where there is no price in effect mm-hmm. or when it's cheaper.
And is there something to be said? You know, one of the things that I read a lot is that with any kind of, you know, any form of congestion pricing, it's a regressive tax, right? Which I think it makes sense to a certain extent, but I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you have to look at the perspective. So I think the key thing people overlook in that conversation is, what is it costing me today, right? So yes, if you're looking at congestion pricing or even a toll, it sounds like you're paying more. But when you take into account your individual value of time, the fuel and the impact on your car sitting in traffic, it might not be a regressive tax. It might be a zero-sum game. Some of that's going to depend on the individual. The other aspect people overlook is how some agencies also use those programs to augment transit services. And I know that's a big part of what LA Metro's looking at. Phil Washington over there has laid out a great concept that they want to be able to use congestion pricing not only to improve traffic in LA, but they want to use it to make transit free by the time the Olympics come around.
You know, on a personal level, mm-hmm. one of the stats on that INRIX traffic study was that you know, because 102 peak hours are spent in traffic, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a productivity lost of approximately $2,900. So, you know, mm-hmm. essentially somebody could be making $2,900
right.
in a year. And I would think to a certain extent that $2,900, if they were driving in and out of LA, or, you know, if I were to use the toll roads for an entire year, I would say, you know, I think $2,900 would be on the higher side of my habits, but mm-hmm. maybe not for somebody else who really uses it on a very frequent basis. Mm-hmm. But now if I have the $2,900 mm-hmm. that's as you had mentioned, that in congestion pricing, if you, you know, to use one of the definitions you use, when for toll roads, you're paying a service, and if you're not using it, then you're not paying for the service, right?
Right.
So if you had the $2,900 extra in your pocket, where would you want to spend that money in relation to transit projects, infrastructure projects? And again, I mean, obviously you're one individual,
right.
But...
Right. Well, you know, really, that is really an individual question. So yeah. I think you'll hear a lot of different opinions there. So,
well, I'm curious though on where you would spend it though.
So, well, for me, I don't look at the 100 hours or the 102 hours financially. I look at it as time with my family, right? And that's key. Actually, the TCAs, we're doing a study right now on a project called the 241-91 Express Connector that will allow folks to go from our facility directly into the 91 Express lanes.
Okay.
This has a huge benefit to the overall corridor going all the way from State Route 55 to Riverside, you know, past I-15. So our studies are showing that with our project, some people will save about that same amount of time. So we view it as, I mean, that's a vacation.
Oh, yeah.
You know, 100 hours a year, that's a vacation. Yep. That's more time to be with your family. And I can't put a price on that.
Fair enough. Fair enough. On LinkedIn, there's a couple things that you had commented on that I would like further explanation from you.
Sure.
Okay. So one thing you had mentioned, you said a new model for funding transportation infrastructure is not an option, but a necessity. The gas tax model is broken and can't be fixed as it bets against technology and doesn't ensure the dollars go to where the utility or service was rendered. Right. Explain that for me.
Right. So the first aspect of that is, you know, we know electric vehicles, right? California is big on electric vehicles. In terms of state comparisons, we have more electric vehicles. I think we have twice as many electric vehicles on the road as any other state. So if we are dependent on the gas tax model to pay for our infrastructure, I don't know how that pans out. It's like that's a bet that the technology in electric vehicles isn't going to continue to prosper and grow. So while, you know, California's done some great things with SB1 and addressing some immediate needs, long term, we have to look beyond the gas tax and realize that technology is going to change our ability to get sufficient revenues from the gas tax, but the usage of the facilities and the need for the facilities is still going to be there. So, you know, when we put all our eggs in that one basket for the gas tax, I feel like we might not be looking at that full long-term picture we need for, you know, my grandkids.
And what would be the alternative then?
So this is where those other models come in. This goes back to what I mentioned earlier about how people are really thinking comprehensively. You've had folks talking about user-based fees, as you mentioned, congestion pricing, continued expansion of express lanes, vehicle mile travels. There are a lot of different ways that transportation can be funded. But key to all these new models is it's based on user-based fees. And that goes to the last part of my comment there that I had on LinkedIn about, you know, you're paying for the actual utility that you use. Yeah. So similar to what you mentioned earlier, if you don't use the toll road, you don't pay, but you can still benefit.
Yep.
So absolutely. As we look at user-based fee models, you know, when you use the service, if you use I-5, you know, you're getting benefit. So yeah. You should pay your fair share of cost for using the I-5.
I mean, would you see then, especially, let's say, in L.A. County, presuming they do deploy some type of congestion pricing, would you also see that complementary to that, there would be the repeal of the gas tax?
So I think you have to look at the balance. And okay. I think that's one of the great, great things that's happening in our conversation today. It's somewhat like buyer's remorse. You know, I still remember when I bought my first house, I'm like, yeah, I got a new house, I'm set. And about 2 years in, I'm like, man, this broke, I got to pay for this. This broke, I got to pay for that. So I think a lot of folks don't understand that, you know, I always hear folks say, well, I already paid for that road. Okay, yeah, I already paid for my house, but that doesn't mean it doesn't need more investments. Mm-hmm. So I think those kind of conversations are happening and people are seeing this full picture. So I think, again, it's going to take a combination of funding approaches to give us the transportation infrastructure we need and to maintain it.
Is there a Is there a particular culture, or is there a particular, you know, city that is best suited for a particular model?
Yeah. You know, that's an interesting question. That comes up a lot when folks talk about cordon pricing, okay. That one aspect. Mm-hmm. So you look at London, right? It's kind of an island,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
I think Stockholm is similar. Yep. I've never been to Singapore, but I think all three of those, they're somewhat landlocked, which makes it, you know, a little easier to draw a ring.
Yeah,
that's not to say it can't be accomplished in other areas, but you know, that's where you've seen these other studies. You know, definitely Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Manhattan's an island. So, in terms of the amount of infrastructure you need to do something like cordon pricing, that's a key consideration in that discussion.
So then, one of the other things you had mentioned was with regards to vehicle miles traveled.
Mm-hmm.
Vehicle miles traveled. I've been thinking about that a lot, okay. And this is how I am trying to process it. So if vehicle miles traveled is a user-based fee, where if I'm in a car, if I'm in a Uber, mm-hmm. if I'm doing micro-mobility, mm-hmm. those miles that I am logging, I essentially have to pay for.
Uh-huh.
To me, then, that starts to model some kind of commodity. All right. So the example I've used is leather. So you out of leather, you can make a football, you can make a basketball, you can make a baseball glove. Mm-hmm. Well, as a commodity, you can buy and sell a commodity. Would miles be a commodity where you can essentially, if you don't use a certain amount of miles, then you can sell it to somebody who is?
You know, that's an interesting concept, Dennis. I haven't heard that spoken to at all. Actually, this is the first time I've heard that. I know that some states are looking at kind of you pay a flat fee directly to the DMV for your vehicle miles, right? It's part of your DMV registration. Maybe in that concept, there's a commodity market option, but you know, you've got an interesting idea, so it'll be okay. Interesting to see how that floats.
All right, let me start to patent all some of that stuff then. So you actually mentioned something that is another interesting method of executing the business models, and that is, could you have more of a flat congestion pricing model?
So I think when you talk about vehicle miles traveled, a lot of folks view that as a flat rate per mile.
Okay.
And that's, it's a viable option from funding. What it doesn't necessarily do is help you manage demand and congestion.
Okay.
So
okay.
If you look at a flat model, even a flat per year amount or a flat per mile rate, it might not accomplish everything that, you know, certain regions would want. And that's probably why, you know, LA is looking at a congestion model, because they really got to manage demand. So it's really those two layers. There's, you know, paying for your transportation infrastructure, but then managing demand.
Mm-hmm.
So I think some regions are going to have to look at a different balance between those two things to accomplish what they're trying to achieve.
Hmm. Okay. Something else that you said on LinkedIn, I'd mm-hmm. like to get your comment on. You said the growth of micro manufacturing and direct digital manufacturing presents a viable option for local production of goods and a new skilled labor force and delivery market.
Yeah, that was Please interesting. I posted that while I was sitting in, I don't remember what conference it was, mm-hmm. but there was a presentation by a group that was essentially 3D printing cars.
Okay.
And they talked about doing it in a micro manufacturing model. So they had these videos, small shop, you know, with skilled people, and they were printing cars on demand. I was like, man, you know, when we talk about trying to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S., you know, we're a technology leader, but manufacturing necessarily hasn't been our forte. So I saw that as a combination of the two, right? And if we can do things like that, where maybe we also reduce demand on our highways, it sounded like a great idea.
That is actually very interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you can almost, I guess, depends on how much that 3D printer costs and just the entire manufacturing of a car like that. But
yeah.
I could almost see that you can almost localize it to regions Yeah. You know, you have TCA that has their own manufacturing facility that only, you know, that produces vehicles that serve this Orange County area.
Yeah. I probably think that's something better served with private industry, but they should do.
No, fair. But it's a public-private partnership. Yeah. You know?
But now that you mentioned, I think the actual name of the company was called Local Motors.
Local Motors. Okay.
Well, so I'd have to look back at that, but very interesting concept.
We will have to look into that a little bit more.
Yeah. Recyclable too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, see, this is why it's interesting to have you on here. I mean, you're like thinking four steps ahead of the game here. So going back to the toll roads, mm-hmm. and just the functionality of the roads itself, mm-hmm. and how things were executed. So I guess, you know, one of the things I'm a little bit interested in knowing about is especially since you're in charge of tolling strategies, have there been changes in the way that the pricing strategy was, you know, what was it 10 years ago now, and what will it be 10 years from now?
So first, I want to make clear. So I'm part of our executive team, so I provide input to our tolling strategy, but we really work well as a team and take the guidance from our board.
You know, somehow though, sorry to interrupt you, somehow I was thinking that, you know, there was like Samuel Johnson who's somehow sitting afloat these tolling areas, and like he's just like pinpointing all these cars, and you're like this wizard up there, you know, but sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no. So, you know, both our boards of elected officials, they provide the guidance for the agency. Agencies and how we should move forward. I would say, you know, you look to your 10 years back, we've been fortunate where we haven't, we've been able to focus our toll rates on paying back the debt, right? And we've established some debt structures that make it, you know, clear projections on what we need to collect in toll revenue from now until the debt's paid off. As we look 10 years out, one of the things we have to think about is our demand is rising. Like I mentioned, 350,000 vehicles per day now, that's gonna continue to grow. We've had, you know, I think for the past few years, we've had like 10% growth year over year. So people continue to see the utility, much the way you mentioned in your personal story, that there's value in using the toll roads. And it's not that people use them every day, they're choice facilities because they parallel, you know, untold routes like the 5 and the 405. So every day someone's making a choice, but those choices are growing as demand for transportation grows. So we're going to get to this point where we have to evaluate, do we use increased pricing levels to manage the demand? Because our goal is to always keep traffic free flow, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody who pays a toll expects to have a free flow trip. So do we use pricing to manage demand, or do we use additional investments in expanding our roadways to handle that demand? So as we move forward, those are going to be key discussions that our boards are going to be having and making decisions and giving staff direction on what we should do.
Is the toll roads looked at as the role model into how the toll roads and the TCA are a profitable endeavor versus, you know, what I saw the other day, like mm-hmm. The state of Texas, mm-hmm. their tolling system is absolutely bankrupt, or I shouldn't say bankrupt, but they're heavily in debt. But it seems to be the case, and please confirm this, that the toll roads is a profitable business where you are able then to take your profits and invest it back into, you know, bettering infrastructure, furthering projects, and things mm-hmm. of that nature.
I probably split that into two aspects. So I think we are indeed a business model, and I can share more with you on that. But, you know, when you talk about government agencies and profit, those things don't necessarily go hand in hand. But our financial model is solid. We've been able, even through the Great Recession, we've been able to keep pace and make our debt service payments, you know, pay back our loans on time, on schedule, since the roads were built.
And why is that?
I think it's good, really good oversight and governance by our board, right? We've got a great executive team. Our current chief executive officer, Mike Kramen, you know, he provides leadership, and we have a skilled management team. We support Mike and give the board the information they need to make decisions. So our board has made very good decisions, including, and this probably shifts into the technology side, where we definitely stand as a model for the world, and going from, you know, toll booths on the road and cash takers and cash machines to what's called all electronic tolling. We've been the model for that. Not that we were first, we weren't. We learned from others, but that is the trend that the world is following.
I think that was probably one of the things that I became more enamored with the toll roads was when now I don't have to stop to pay.
Right.
And while, you know, of course, there were times where I was using the toll and, you know, for whatever reason, no one, this, you know, I think this was maybe a transitionary period where there was a time where, okay, there's someone in the booth and there wasn't someone in the booth. So someone in the booth, someone not in the booth, right? But then, so certainly there were times where no one's in the booth and you just kind of drive straight through and you kind of know you're going to get that penalty or whatever the case. But correct me if I'm wrong here. Did you guys do something where even where at some point where there was no more penalty, it was like, look, you're not going to be penalized for driving the toll, but what you have to do is you do have to pay the usage. And then what seemed to happen, the kind of user experience I went through was I had to sign up for an account, which is great. Now you have information on me, the a user on this toll road. And then once you sign up for an account, you register your license. Now, like, that's it. Like, I don't, and I guess, so what would be the need for the transponder versus just not having the transponder and just having the photo taken?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is definitely an area where TCA has been one of the first. We offer a lot of different ways for folks to pay their tolls, but not with cash or not by stopping on the road, which causes congestion. So key to us, and, you know, we want to keep toll rates as low as possible. So we have to manage our costs. So when you talk about those two different things, if we're processing a transaction using the image of the license plate versus reading a transponder, the cost of reading a transponder is much, much lower.
Okay.
It's immediate. It's faster. There's no risk of error. When we have to take a picture of a license plate, right, it takes a lot of work. And this is one of the things we did when we converted to all electronic tolling. We upgraded our camera systems. And for some locations, we take as many as 12 pictures of a vehicle to make sure we get a good picture of that license plate.
Interesting.
And then we try and process it automatically with computers, right, to see if the computers can figure out what the license plate number is. But then in the background, if the computers don't get it, we have to have humans look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at that cost side versus, you know, a transponder, there's a significant difference in cost.
So there's essentially no error with a transponder, but there's still a small margin of error, or at least there's additional labor.
Correct.
In the second way of when it, the camera is just taking a picture of your license.
Correct.
You know, now I'm going to ask a popular question, and I kind of know the answer already to this because I looked this up when I was working at a dealership, and you know, we had to deliver cars from at the time Audi Mission Viejo to, let's say, somebody in Newport Beach, and we used a 73, and of course it's a new car, and there's no license plate on there, so what happens then? So for the listeners who would fit this model, they just get a new car, they don't have a license plate on there, what happens with them and what should they do?
Great opportunity for a public service announcement.
Great.
So one of the great things that the California legislature did actually a couple of years ago was pass a law requiring that all vehicle sales from licensed dealers, that vehicle must have either a already issued regular license plate or one of our new temporary paper plates affixed to the vehicle before it leaves the lot.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so that law went into effect this past January. So as you look out there on the road, you may see new cars and you're going to be like, what's that on the back?
That's interesting. I was in LA yesterday and I saw a car that did have, like, I can't confirm it was a paper plate, but it certainly wasn't a normal plate. And if anything, I just thought it was an out-of-state plate, but it didn't have like a, you know, it didn't look prominent enough that it looked like it was an out-of-state plate. So maybe that was it.
More than likely, that's what it was. So that went into effect in January. So this is the public service announcement. If you're buying a new car, before you leave that lot, make sure your dealer has done their responsibility and affixed that plate to your vehicle. Because if you CHP or, you know, law enforcement catches you on the road and you don't have a plate affixed to your vehicle, you're going to get a citation.
See, boom, the more you know. Samuel, drop the knowledge here. All right, a few more questions here for you.
Sure.
So, public-private partnerships. Are you guys engaged in that?
So we do consider what TCA has put in place a public-private partnership, but it doesn't have a profit component. So a lot of people think of public-private partnerships as when a private investor has come and they've bought, say, a concession to operate the roads, and they put all the money in, and they get to operate the roads, and they charge the tolls that they see fit, and it may still be congestion pricing based or other models, but then they have a profit incentive. The great thing about TCA's model is there's no profit incentive. Yes, we have bonds, and we issue debt based on the future collection of tolls to pay for the road, but that's where the money goes. So there's you know, no one getting profit in their pockets because of what we're doing here at TCA. So we think we are a somewhat unique model in that regards, because again, we are not directly part of the state. We are our own independent two agencies comprised of local cities and the county supervisory districts that wanted to see this happen. So they maintain control, and they're providing the transportation infrastructure we need in South Orange County.
And is there, do you see any relevance to a public-private partnership funding infrastructure anywhere in the U.S.?
Absolutely. There's some good models out there that work. So especially if you, I think the first one I can think of is the Capital Beltway, Interstate 495 back in Virginia, in the D.C. area. I believe they have a concession agreement there where the concessionaire has come in and they've helped build the infrastructure, and they've built it with their money, right? And now they get to collect the tolls, you know, to pay back, you know, and recoup their investment. So there are different models. And this goes back to what I was saying earlier. To meet our financial demands for transportation, right? You know, people talk a lot about, you know, the advances society has had from, you know, communications, healthcare, but transportation has probably been the biggest leap. When we talk about the ability to move people, goods, and now data, I mean, that's just critical to our success. So figuring out how we manage surface transportation and look at the wealth of options any region or state can have in terms of getting their communities the infrastructure they need, I think you should have flexibility, and each region needs to do what's best for them.
It is often inspiring to hear from a gentleman like Samuel Johnson. His business is his family, and the roads that take him to his family is his business. And the mindset and the mind frame that it takes to adopt that mentality is a very different one. It is very different to think about whether you are self-employed or you are a W-2 employee, that your business is your family business. Usually you would associate your business to the work that you are doing. So that mind shift in thinking that your business is now your family is an admirable and, as I say again, inspiring one. And it didn't happen overnight either. Let's not make a mistake here. The toll roads have been around since the mid 80s, and it's taken this long for them to get to a position of operating their business profitably and responsibly. And I, as a customer of their services, am a happy customer. And when I'm not happy, when I haven't been happy, there's been a moment of pause. And sometimes that pause took a couple years, a few years. And they did what they should be doing, and that is to always look out for the family. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Wisco Weekly. I'm very, very grateful for your listens, and I hope you continue to listen and subscribe to the show. There are lots of exciting topics and upcoming events. For Kelly, Rudy, and myself, cheers, prost, l'chaim, kipis, nastravi, salut, kampai, mabruk, tutsins, gambe, yamas, to the customer experience.